With the False Claims Act, Mike, I know you have prosecuted False Claims Act cases. I can't recall if you were handled or worked on them back when you were with the government, but it's a very powerful tool that can be used by our government. And there is some, if we could delve a little bit into legal issues, there's a case out of in front of the 11th Circuit right now, which is going to look at the constitutionality of False Claims Acts. Any real thoughts on whether or not that's going to continue, or this Supreme Court would throw out literally 120, 160 years of key TAM whistleblower type laws?
Yeah, I don't think this Supreme Court's going to. There have been talks about the constitutionality. I know there's a case, or there are several cases that are trying to address it. Where I see the Supreme Court, I think it was last year, addressed that there was an intent issue for a False Claims Act and an anti-kickback. And they really, once they heard the issue, they sort of ducked it right away. They didn't want to get into it. Now, would they attack it? Would they attack, wholesale? I'd be really surprised if they did. But you never know with this group. You know, we're seeing just some bizarre sort of alliances sometimes set up, or majorities coming together. So you never can tell. But I know there are people who've been pushing on the constitutionality of it. You know, once you open an area up to False Claims Act whistleblowers, your risks go way up. And so what they're using in the trade area is a doctrine they developed called the reverse false claims, where when you fail to pay the government a duty, that is almost, it's sort of the reverse of the usual situation, is when the government is reimbursing you for a medical expense, let's say. And so now it's a reverse situation, and they're pushing the law. There's no question. And every administration has done that because it's vitally important to protect government programs and government, particularly in the healthcare area. And now we're seeing it being, they're trying to apply the same expanded doctrines in the trade enforcement area. And, you know, they're going to collect money. That's what they like to do. And so I'd be surprised if the Supremes would reverse it. They may play at the margins on some of the cases, but I don't think, you know, where the government gets a little bit too far ahead of itself, I just don't see that gaining any ground. But there is more support for it. I've noticed that. But I think that's more kind of like Chamber of Commerce influencing organizations to get behind.
Like, I had a long talk with Mary Inman, one of the leading whistleblowers, pro-whistleblower lawyers in the country, about the tariffs issue. And she kind of educated me that actually FCA has been used in tariff cases for years, because right, companies would get wind that a competitor was not paying tariffs and bring that information to the government. And sometimes it resulted in an FCA case. Sometimes it resulted in a direct prosecution from the government. But one of the interesting things I've seen from this DOJ is actually calling out corporations to turn in other corporations who may cheat, because they view this as a national security issue. Have you had that experience as well?
I have not, but I definitely agree with Mary's point. And I've noticed in sort of the corporate enforcement efforts and the recent DOJ pronouncements, they welcome whistleblowers who are competitors to come in and encourage them to do so. You hit the nail on the head in terms of that being an issue, no question. And that, I've always said, use the government to do some of your work. If you know a competitor is beating you through illegal means, don't investigate it yourself and try to bring a case. Get the government to do it. And that way you can then piggyback off whatever the government does. And I don't think there was the same culture. I think the companies were so afraid of being the object of a whistleblower complaint that they couldn't really agree to be a whistleblower themselves. But I did a case years ago in California that was brought by a competitor, and exactly because they were importing an item that that basically put them at a disadvantage against the American, an advantage against the American competitors, and they weren't allowed to import that item. These guys reported them, and they ultimately got a settlement out of it, and the CEO of the company went to jail. So we did that, and so they didn't hesitate there because they were losing market share because of that, and they could identify the cause of that. But it was a relatively small industry, and it was in the tungsten industry, and it's public. And so that led to, I think, you know, there's greater embrace of being a corporate whistleblower by a company, which I think is they should. You should look out for competitors. I always said in the bribery area, if somebody's paying bribes and you suspect it or have reason to believe it, and you're losing out in government in contracts, that's where you should be, you know, saying, hey, this is in a level playing field.
Mike, are there any other areas that either you or the greater Volkoff Law Group are looking at harder, more diligently, or in a new way into 2026 than perhaps you have in the past?
I think the story of where we are now in compliance, besides, I'm just happy that we started off with ethics and culture. But the real issue is now technology and, you know, ChatGPT, AI, and all the, you know, bloviating about it. There's so much written about it, but the risks are real. And, you know, as a lawyer, I can tell you I'll use AI and I'm surprised how wrong it is. I'll double check it just to see. And how many times where if I did something and relied on this, I could get in trouble just from an ethical standpoint. But imagine if us lawyers see the risks in our own area. What are the risks facing the businesses when they use it? Let alone the intellectual property issues that come up, let alone the fact that people aren't sort of, you know, less, there's less direct control over the content and actions than people take. And I'll tell this one story in terms of one of the clients that I have. They, you know, we were in the middle of a risk assessment and they said, we don't do AI. We don't use it. We have a committee that's, you know, looking at use cases and thinking about doing it. And then lo and behold, I'm talking to the finance side and they said, oh, we've been using AI for a while. We're using it to, you know, verify payments and, you know, in our financial systems to find anomalies. And that to me was a real concern. In other words, people are embracing using technology without there being corporate control over it. And companies can get in real trouble in this area if they don't. There are great technologies now, and compliance, for example, itself should be using data, analytics, AI, all the things that we're talking about in a properly controlled manner. And that's, I see that as a bigger risk because I think people are, I don't want to say lazy, but it's just so easy to push a button and think you have something that's valuable when you have to be really careful of content risks here, let alone if you're in an industry where there's, you know, you're making loan decisions or real estate type thing, you know, where there could be discrimination and employment, there can be real risks in those areas. So I see that as a big issue that people need to address. And I would say one other issue, Tom, we sort of referred to it earlier on, is make sure your conflict of interest issues and controls and program with annual disclosures, automation, all of that is in good shape. Because I've seen several situations, the most work we've done this year is in the conflict of interest area. And that is where, you know, there's already a hotline established. And this was amazing. In this one case, there was a conflict of interest and they got four anonymous complaints on the same issue from separate reporters. And to me, that says something. There's a good part to that story, which is that they believe in the system and they would put in reports and use the hotline. But the conflict of interest issue was just blatant and people were upset about it. And so I think that companies and compliance usually ends up leading this area because it falls to them. And I think compliance should grab it because it's a great opportunity to tie directly into your ethical culture and to demonstrate it. So and we saw the corporate scandals that we talked about. There's the Kohler scandal. There's the Nestle. There's the Kiss Cam. And all of those situations are situations where it wasn't necessarily a violation of a law. It was a violation of your internal law, your code of. So I think that's the story. That's a big, to me, along with trade enforcement, that's probably your biggest issue for the next year.
So one of the things that interested me, or one of my observations, was that certainly white collar enforcement has been significantly cut back by this administration. But companies are being punished in the marketplace, and it's hitting not the bottom line, but the top line, meaning they are not getting sales. And so they're bringing in less revenue. And once you don't get a sale, you can't make that up. Now, a customer can come back, certainly at some point down the road, but once the sale's lost, it's lost forever. And that I'm seeing the marketplace in the form of either consumers, employees, localities, or a variety of other stakeholders really want companies to act more ethically and in compliance with their own internal rules and regulations.
Look, one of the upsides of our internet technology economy is that it doesn't take much for dissatisfied customers or people who don't like behavior by certain corporate actors to gain momentum on the internet, on social media. And that is an important check, because what do you think happened to Nestle, Kohler in particular, and, you know, or Kohl's, not Kohler, I should say, but Kohl's in particular, you know, suffered serious harm from that and reputational damage. And I think, you know, corporate leaders use that expression about, you know, their reputation, how important that is. But what you're talking about is that the marketplace is a place where they get disciplined. And I think that's really true. And to me, let's say one of the most heartbreaking stories were that when the New York Times did a series on child labor in the fragrance industry, and that you had 5 to 8 year old kids picking flowers in parts of Africa, 5 levels down in your supply chain. And these, you know, big name fragrance companies were, we didn't know this. We didn't know about this. They were hammered. And lo and behold, now there's a antitrust cartel investigation of the fragrance industry. Now, did it start from there? I don't know, but look at what happened. And they've taken so many hits. And the story is heartbreaking when you read about these children being, you know, into forced labor situations. And I don't think people are ready to accept that your supply chain has, let's say, something like that in it. People are going to react to it. And I'm sure, you know, that New York Times series was unreal. It was incredibly done. But can you imagine being in one of those companies and having to deal with, how do we explain this? You know, you can, what is it? You can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig, as they say. And so that's why the marketplace is holding people accountable, just like the employees are saying, we expect our leaders to operate in a certain way. And when it doesn't happen, there's no question that, you know, employee morale goes down. And what happens when the morale goes down is misconduct rates go up. Look, the ethical premium, in my view, I describe it a little bit differently, is that the number of misconduct incidents in an ethical company goes down by 2/3 in comparison. That's pretty significant. And, you know, think about it. And I know 80% of all the misconduct reports are HR related, but all you need is one or two of somebody stealing, somebody falsely reporting information, or every conflict of interest issue that I've started to investigate, we found other criminal activity or other misconduct bordering on criminal. It's like a loss leader for really serious actions. And I, frankly, having consumers hold people accountable in the marketplace is, I think it's terrific. And people and companies have to respond to that, Tom, like you're saying.
But the other areas that interested me in this arena is of financial institutions, banks, private equity companies, insurance companies, those that typically either help fund companies, help companies gain access to their own cash or capital, and those who help with overall risk management, i.e. insurance companies, are also taking a stronger look because they've come to realize if a company is willing to violate its own internal policies and procedures, what are they going to say in financial statements? Will they screw a bank? Will they screw a PE company?
Right.
J.P. Morgan had a multi-million dollar lesson from Charlie Javis.
Right.
Now they ended up having the DOJ bring criminal charges and may get something there. But it was a huge embarrassment to J.P. Morgan around not doing basic and simple due diligence on an acquisition. So I think the marketplace has finally started, the marketplace in terms of entities who help you access your own cash in your organization have come to realize that at least following your own policies and procedures, doing business ethically and in compliance is a pretty good indicator. And you called it a loss leader, and I think you're spot on there.
But you know, Tom, what is interesting and sort of dovetails with what your point is, I've seen the due diligence or the questionnaires or the documentation when a bank or whatever wants information from a company. That level of inquiry has quadrupled easily in the last 10 years. In other words, we want documentation of your program. We want this. We want that. And before they're even going to think of loaning you money, we want to see what your compliance and your program looks like. We want to know about any investigations. We want to know about, you know, reporting. What kind of company are we going to do business with? And I think that's really grown significantly, not because necessarily of FinCEN, you know, enforcement actions or DOJ enforcement actions. Apparently, DOJ is going to go after banks more, global banks at least. But that's what they say. But it's more about what's the impact if you are in bed with or loaning money to or supporting or knew about this and didn't do anything about it. So now third-party risk is suddenly coming to the, you know, the larger institutions. And what I've seen is absolutely more robust due diligence, inquiries, everything with regard to that, because I get asked to help to respond to it. And that is a huge deal. So I've also seen, just even in the sanctions area, where banks will just say, okay, we know, it reminds me of a judge I was once in front of, and the judge said to me, Mr. Volkoff, I know that's what the law requires, but I'm going to do this, okay? And it's the judge's law in the courtroom. And here, where I've seen it analogously is with sanctions enforcement or sanctions issues. There are transactions that banks say, we're not going to do it. I'm not doing this, they say. And so we call them up. We say, look, this is legal and here's why it's legal. X, Y, Z. I'll give you a legal opinion. While it's legal, we don't want to do it. Because why? We don't want the risk. We don't want the appearance of, let's say, doing a Russian transaction. And I think that's not because of any legal requirement. It's because of what you're talking about. They don't want it to ever be known that they process this transaction.
Is there anything else that you think we should touch on or highlight for our listeners going forward into 2026?
One last issue I wanted to raise with you, and I am seeing this more concern about this, and you put private equity into the equation. And there's private equity. I think one of the things that consumers, employees, are getting a little bit more concerned about is private equity and their commitment beyond just, can I flip this property and make money? Can I take this company and do this? And one of the sort of lost leaders I've seen forever with private equity, and I think you have as well, is, you know, not much commitment to compliance and ethics. And I think that this may occur more in certain industries as private equity comes in and takes over certain industries. And people are realizing that when you have ultimate ownership in the private equity area, there are some real concerns that can come up from in terms of employee relations, compliance, and overall culture. So to me, that's a growing trend. And I think it's something we should stay on top of. I don't see the same commitment from private equity companies that, let's say, have 300 portfolio companies of saying, hey, we're going to make sure all these companies have ethics and compliance and are really good at employee relations. And I don't think they invest in that because it's not part of the financial equation for how they're going to make money.
Well, that's certainly an interesting idea and avenue to approach. I think that based upon what we've talked about in this podcast, that they may need to rethink that approach because there are so many other stakeholders in addition to the government. And if you want to even include the government, this administration is not going to be here forever. And so at some point, the pendulum's going to swing back. So hopefully that message will at least get itself to private equity.
Yeah. We'll see. It's a longer term issue, but it's one that I'm seeing more and more of and hearing more about in terms of people raising concerns about it. So we'll see. But I think it's going to be a great year, though, Tom. I think we should be optimistic as always. We are. You and I have always been optimists. It's easier to, you know, what I believe in is the value of ethics and culture is always vindicated. It will always be vindicated. And no matter what, because it's part of the human condition that people want to be active in areas and for entities that they believe in and missions that they believe in.
Mike, and I guess I would just end by saying that if the second Trump administration had happened in 2010, we might be having a very different conversation now about ethics and compliance. But the institutions and institutional aspects of ethics and compliance, I think, are so ingrained in our businesses and our organizations and our corporations and all of the other groups that we've talked about that I think it will withstand this administration.
Oh, yeah. No question. No question. Thanks, Tom. Always great to talk to you.
And Mike, thanks again. I look forward to continuing this conversation.